Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 439th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen, a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today, with us, we have Adrian Lindblad. Sorry, there was going to be a drum roll there, and I forgot that. Adrian, take it away.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I'm Adrian. I am the Knowledge Translation and Evidence Coordinator for the Alberta College of Family Physicians and an Associate Clinical Professor in Family Medicine at the U of A.
And we all work for Pierre.
Yeah, we all work for Pierre. Yes. And Mike and I are between the ages of 40 and 70.
Excellent.
And I'm wondering if you have any help for us.
Possibly.
If people are wondering where we're going with this, Mike, do you want to let him know? Because I can't say it.
I will say that I begged him to try and maintain some moderate level of decorum.
Which is why
that is gone.
Which is why I passed it over to you.
So today, Adrian, you've done a number of tools for practice recently, which we're going to cover in a series of podcasts. But the first one we're reviewing is your look at the phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors. Many will know that as the drugs like Viagra and Cialis and that kind of thing. So they're often known better by their brand name. But you're going to take us through the evidence for these drugs.
Yes, I am.
Take it away.
Excellent. So we looked at this. I had a PharmD student with me who wanted to get into this topic a little bit more. And we thought it would be a fairly open and shut case and fairly easy because everyone's always heard things about how wonderful these drugs work and how they have very few side effects. But it ended up being a little more complicated than we thought it would. And one of the reasons is because a lot of the systematic reviews and RCTs have looked at scales, and they've looked at certain scales like the International Index of Erectile Function, and they haven't always interpreted them correctly or used them in a way that makes sense to readers. At least when I say that, I mean me, because I didn't understand it. And so I tend to think if I can't understand something, then other people will probably have trouble as well. So we tried to look only at evidence that actually used some type of a patient-oriented outcome that was easy to explain and understand. And one of the ones that we found was actually looking at the proportion of successful sexual intercourse attempts. We thought that was probably the easiest outcome that you could explain to a patient or that a patient would want to know. Otherwise, you can be looking at things about, were you able to get an erection during sexual activity, or how long did that last, and things like that. And that's not always necessarily a relevant outcome.
And I know we've looked at this in the past, but who did they ask whether or not it was successful?
Well, that is a very good question. And how do you define successful? Yeah. But it's it's usually just up to the patient, and they usually leave it along those lines of it was a successful sexual intercourse attempt, and they kind of leave that up for the patient to define what exactly that means.
Yes.
But it can mean it's usually looking at something along the lines of the erection was sufficiently hard and long-lasting for satisfactory intercourse.
Yeah. I actually think this is probably, and as you indicated right at the start, Adrian, this is probably the best outcome. And it's kind of like, and we've advocated for this in the past, one of the outcomes for acne, for example, is acne counts, the number of blackheads versus whiteheads, comb, and those kind of things aren't as important, I think, as asking patients, do you think you're better and mm-hmm. how much better? Those kind of things where we're getting patients involved, like and it stands true for depression too. Do you think this is helping you? All of those kind of things. So just a simple question to patients, basically asking them if the drug was effective for the concern they had. That is probably the best outcome that we can measure most times when it's a symptomatic condition.
And wouldn't it be cool if it was sort of a requirement that every study that did something on symptomatic, actually, you can do all the other scales you want, but have that one thing, you know, do you feel better? And maybe...
Do you think you're better?
Yeah. Like, I mean, how...
It's insane, so James. Cool.
I know.
It's insane that that's not part of it, right? Yeah. Because they could all have that, whether it be pain, mood, and literally any outcome apart from some, you know, dichotomous thing like cardiovascular events or something
heart attacks
like that.
And strokes all and stuff, of these,
all of these could have that. But you know, eczema, atopic dermatitis, if you like, whatever it is, you could have that outcome. But unfortunately, it's rare. But you I think targeted in on that, Adrian. So tell us a little bit about what you found.
Yeah, we did. So first we found was one of the most comprehensive systematic reviews. It's about 10 years old now, but they had 130 RCTs, and they looked at most of the different PDE5 inhibitors. So sildenafil, vardenafil, tadalafil, mirodenafil, eudenafil. I hope I'm pronouncing all of those right. That's how I've always
said. That was awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
we can end the podcast right there because people clearly know we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Excellent. And so in these 130 RCTs, they had over 30,000 people with erectile dysfunction of any cause. And they used the drugs for about 12 weeks. And then when they looked at the number of men who had successful sexual intercourse attempts, it was about 65% of people who got the PDE5 inhibitors compared to 30% on placebo, which was, of course, statistically significant. They then also looked at the number of patients with self-reported improved erections, and that was just in quotation marks. I don't really know what exactly that means. And in this case, it was about 78% of men compared to 31% on placebo, and that's the number needed to treat of about 3.
And what's interesting is sort of the placebo group, because the placebo group is very dependent on the population that you put in.
Like, yes, for sure.
You know, because I've seen studies that it ranges. It can be as low as sort of 5 or 10% response rate, upwards of, you know, the 40 or so percent. And so it very much depends on, you know, what the underlying cause is of the erectile dysfunction.
Absolutely. There was a different systematic review of 8 RCTs just looking at men with diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the placebo response rate was about 15%.
Yeah.
A little bit less, yeah. But you end up with a number needed to treat of around 3, which is very similar because of the response rate, which is about 58% in that group for people who got the PDE5 inhibitors.
So and you have a couple other ones. There's one with 118, and the NNT there is 2.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really finding anything different, Adrian, as you'll point out. I'm sure it's 78 to 31 is 3% away from an NNT of 2, and these guys just had that little extra push to get them there to that NNT of 2. But these, as James and I have said before, and I'm sure you were kind of indicating at the beginning, these are highly effective medicines.
Absolutely.
Overall.
Yeah. There's not a lot of things that have an NNT of 2 or 3.
Yes. Not so very many.
Which I'm sure you guys have talked about before on here. So that's pretty phenomenal that they do tend to work that well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then in terms of side effects, so probably about 44% of men do have some kind of a side effect. It's usually like a headache, flushing, dyspepsia, that type of thing, compared to about 24% on placebo. But what's fascinating is that not a lot of people actually stop the medications due to side effects. So you're looking at maybe around 1% to 3% of men will actually stop due to side effects. That's a number needed to harm around 52 to 300.
Yeah, I find it interesting to say it's fascinating. Because
it's
completely freaking obvious in my mind. Because if there was any medication that had a 20% absolute increase in the chances of headaches, flushing, and dyspepsia, it may not make it on the market.
Mm.
You know,
this is where we start to talk about. You know, we often report in Tools for Practice and on the podcast. The outcome of withdrawal due to adverse events.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we don't talk about is withdrawal due to lack of effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
Which is another way of reporting kind of as a dichotomous outcome, how good the intervention was. And that's exactly what you guys are both indicating. That's kind of what's going on here. The intervention works very well, so people are willing to tolerate some adverse events. And we know that in clinical trials, and we know that in our patients. So patients who get a dramatic effect, I remember a patient of mine had been profoundly affected by depression and had tried multiple antidepressants and found one that was really very, very effective and had a important adverse event, but wasn't willing to quit because of the adverse event, because the depression was far worse than the adverse event. And so I think it's interesting how we can kind of draw this data out. So this is telling us on both sides, one, that people were probably quitting, that we don't have that data here, but people were probably quitting the placebo group because of lack of effectiveness, and they're willing to tolerate the adverse events because of how effective the intervention is.
I was going to say the relatively unique thing about this is, you know, most of the time when we're talking about medications, we're talking about medications that people are taking on a fairly regular basis. This is sort of, and I'm using air quotes, as needed type of thing, you know, so, you know that those adverse events are going to go away.
Yeah, this is like Ventolin, right? It's a little bit like Ventolin, like that. So you use Ventolin, you feel better right away. And that's why many people prefer to use Ventolin to their other types of puffers, because they feel so much better right away.
Exactly the same thing. And a lot of people will report, especially, you know, some people can be very sensitive to Ventolin, like one or two puffs, they'll start to get tremor and that sort of stuff. Some people can just take literally pounds of it, or kilograms, I guess I should be saying. And don't notice anything, but yeah, you know, people can become, you know, they can have issues with blood pressure and so on with Ventolin, but again, it's because of the magnitude of the benefit, it's people tolerate it.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, no, there is. So it's interesting because I know one of the PDE5 inhibitors, specifically tadalafil, has been sort of promoted as something that you can use daily as opposed to on demand.
Oh yeah, for sure. So
yeah, supposed to increase the, you know, spontaneity of things. And they've compared the on-demand to the daily dosing, and they haven't really found any clinically meaningful difference in some of those erectile function scores, and they haven't found any difference in adverse event discontinuation rates either.
That's interesting, actually, because you think that if you were taking it all the time, it would be more that you, because you get the adverse event more consistently, and people would at least gravitate away from the continual and switch to the on-demand, but that's apparently not the case. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm, it is. I agree.
And I don't know. And obviously, this is the point where in the podcast where I have to mention that, and it's about dose. You know,
bing!
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're at 12 minutes and 21 seconds. Now, I don't know, when you guys looked at, did you guys look at all at anything to do with doses? I can't remember.
No.
Yeah.
I don't think we did either. I can't remember either.
Yeah, because I know there are a number of studies, like not, there's, you know, you're talking about 130 randomized controlled trials, but there are a number of trials that I'm aware of that looked, you know, that look at using a half or a quarter of the dose, because when sildenafil came on the market, Mike told me that 100 milligrams was the dose that people should be using. That was supposed to be a joke, and you didn't take the bait there, Mike.
Bing.
Yeah, and I'm sure many people, I'm sure you guys have probably heard people tell you that, you know, at the time, one, it caused a number of side effects and the cost associated with it, and people have used, you know, a half or a quarter or an eighth, and I've even seen a 16th of a 100 milligram tablet being used, and people are saying that it in some cases it is quite effective. And so I think with all of these things, as with every other medication for symptomatic conditions, it's really worth, you know, identifying what is the lowest dose that works, because as with all medications, when they come on the market, the first dose that comes on the market is definitely not the lowest dose that will work in the vast majority of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, James, how many podcasts have we done?
I'm not going to say anything. You just go ahead and be your little spiteful self.
I'm just wondering if we missed any opportunities to talk about dose.
No, we haven't. No. And this is our 439th, and this is the 439th podcast that you've not been very nice to me.
I was hoping it would be 438, but
I think it's an important thing because I think, you know, erectile dysfunction aside, I have spoken to so many people who, when you ask them, why are you on that dose? They say, well, that was the dose I was told to take. And, you know, the concept that the dose that we give them may not be the best dose for them is relatively, is not really something that they particularly think about. And they just assume, I think they assume that we know what the hell we're doing.
there's an important caveat to all of this, or not a caveat, but in addition to what you're saying, is that the 100 milligram dose doesn't differ incredibly from the cost of the 25 milligram dose.
Yeah.
So a 100 milligram dose cut in quarters could be potentially very cost savings for patients.
No, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the doses, most of the tablets are priced independent of dose, and so they're the same price for each different tablet that you get, whether it's a 50 or 100.
Yeah. And actually, that applies not just to this class of medications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, no, it's true, but it's very important any drugs that are very expensive like this, the idea of cutting the pill in halves or quarters. Because as you mentioned, you're right that many patients will get a benefit from a much lower dose. And so they could be potentially cutting the cost almost in a quarter to get the same effect. It's just important to remember and remind patients. I virtually never prescribe any dose for sildenafil, for example, that isn't 100 milligrams. But I tell every patient that they should be taking it or trying it at a quarter of that mm-hmm. pill. Adrian.
No, I'm just going to say, and typically when we talk about all these studies, we say, you know, are there any limitations to the studies? Because, you know, we often sort of pick apart studies, but were there any with this class of medications?
Oh, of course there were. And it's a lot of it's going to be the same that you're going to hear for virtually anything. So the first issue is most of these are industry supported. That's fairly common. A lot of them, though, we don't really know how they randomized people. Blinding is very suspect in terms of what it was done. They often don't even comment if things were blinded or not. And then the other thing that comes up again is just these ideas of these scales and how they're reported and how they're used is a little bit tricky to sort through, which is why we like that dichotomous outcome that we talked about at the start of the podcast.
And actually, I would suggest that probably with these studies, they'd be quite difficult to blind properly. I mean, for two reasons. One, they have an impressive effect. You know, if you have people who have, you know, typically get no response in any way, shape, or form, and they do, that's relatively a dead giveaway. And also the dose related adverse events, you know, that they get. I mean, it's really difficult to do that. But the cool thing about this is that these medications are, again, so effective, at least from a percentage perspective, that I don't think it matters about those limitations. I don't think we're saying in any way, shape, or form that you could have these trials be way less well done, and it still wouldn't get rid of the fact that these drugs have an effect because of the absolute magnitude.
Absolutely.
As you said, we do tend to look at concerns around the trials, and I hope people now know that we're not saying to disbelieve them or ignore the results. That's hardly it. And this is one of those cases where even if the results were biased, it's not the level of bias would not account for a difference of 80% versus 30%. It's just not going to come to that, nearly that magnitude.
Yeah.
And so these drugs are effective. It's kind of like, and I was going to ask you, Adrian, for the pure nerd in me, if they did pool all these scales, they'd use standard mean differences, and those standard mean differences, I bet you, would be massive.
Yep.
They would, but equally biased. So I think you chose the right outcome, but this would be one of those times where standard mean difference would, all it would tell you is they seem to work really quite well and consistently.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
So given what's the final sort of bottom line, so to speak?
Well, the bottom line is they work really well. So they increase the proportion of successful sexual intercourse attempts by about 65% of people versus 30% on placebo. That's about for every three men given one of these drugs compared to placebo, an additional one will have an improved erection or improved erections. So they do work really well. And like we said before, people don't generally stop them for side effects.
And what was the cost of them, Adrian? Because I saw you added that in.
Yeah, so in Alberta, it's about $13 to $16 per tablet. So about $50 to $65 if you're dispensing four tabs at a time.
Yeah, and so it is still pretty costly, but not... And if I remember correctly, this has pretty much been fixed for 15 years.
Yeah, it's been the same for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can imagine, you know, so if you're talking about, you know, $15 a tablet... If you cut it in a quarter, you're now you know, you're now down to $4 or whatever. And I think even that is much more acceptable because, and I think it's appropriate. These are generally not covered by public drug plans, as you say in the tools of practice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a huge patient group out there, you know, desperately pushing the government to say you must pay for these. Maybe there is. I just don't know about them.
It would be difficult to advocate for that. I would think, especially as you mentioned, when there are ways to make these with the cutting of the pills and everything less expensive. Yeah. But. And I don't see that changing in the near future, maybe when they become generic. But in Canada, generics don't drop dramatically in price right away. They reduce in price, but there's not a huge difference between brand names and generics.
Yeah, often. Although it is getting actually a lot better. There are a number of rules now in place where, you know, if you think back years, you know, when I was in practice, and I'm sure when with you guys, you know, the generics used to be about, it varied, but they were upwards of 80% of the actual brand name prices.
Yeah,
and now
I remember that SSRIs. Yeah,
yeah.
There's
a number of things in place that are making it so that they. I think some, and I don't know exactly. I don't know, Adrian, if you know, but there's a big push to keep the generic prices at around 20 to 25%, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe a little bit higher of the brand name prices because. We in Canada, we actually had, to the best of my knowledge, some of the highest generic prices in the world, like even higher than in the States.
We do have higher generic, or we did have higher generic prices. Where we, the draw card for citizens of the U.S. to come up and get Canadian was for brand name products. It was never for generics.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So there were always ways around the cost. And I think one of the biggest ones is, as you've said, is pill splitting, and you know, I'm sure that's done on a fairly regular basis, especially when there's pretty good evidence that you can use much lower doses. So, anything else you guys want to? I know, Mike, you desperately want to go on about erectile dysfunction, but
I keep having hopes that you can rise above your 50-year-old stunted age, but nope, that's not going to happen.
I'm glad that you you. You clearly must be just looking at the way I look because I'm actually 60.
Yeah, no, I'm saying developmentally.
Oh no, developmentally, I'm certainly not past my teen years.
Let's wrap it up, James.
Let's do that.
So go ahead, James.
No, you, Mike, you wrap this up in a perfect bow. That way, I don't need to be criticized. A perfect little present with a bow on it. Go ahead.
Here, I think Adrian wrapped up that this drug is effective for completing intercourse with a 65% versus 30. So, and then for attaining a satisfactory erection, it was 80 versus 30. So the number needed to treat is either around 3 or 2. And there are adverse events like headaches, but people generally won't quit due to those adverse events. Now, James, you have something to sell. You have a course coming up.
We do have a course coming up, and we just posted the people can now sign up for the course. You can find the links on our website. All of the speakers are in place. It's in April 24, 25 here in lovely Vancouver. So we would love it if you would come out and sort of spend the weekend with us. And yeah, I don't think there's anything else we need to sell. So thanks to Adrian for doing the podcast. And I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Bye.